Okay, good morning, everyone. Let me just, before we get started today, let me just say, hopefully you've all seen that the first homework has been posted, and I also sent out a link to solutions for the tutorial. So once everybody has had a chance to try tutorials, I will continue to upload solutions. If you're wanting solutions to a tutorial that hasn't been posted because you think it would be helpful for the homework, just feel free to come talk to me and we can arrange that. I'll either kind of show you the parts that you're wondering about if it hasn't been posted yet, or we'll talk about how we could accommodate that if you're feeling like it would help you with the homework. So just please reach out about that. So today's lecture is going to be all about convolutional neural networks, which we called CNNs as an abbreviation. So let me just write down a few key terms that we're going to introduce throughout the lecture. So these are just some key words that come up when you're talking about these CNNs. And I hope by the end of the lecture, it will be clear what these mean. So throughout this lecture, we'll talk about local receptive fields, channels, the idea of weight and bias sharing, and also something called pooling, which is a way that we can coarse grain in these CNNs. So let me just very quickly remind you of what we've been looking at for several lectures. So these were called fully connected feed-forward neural networks. I can write this as FFNNs. And so what we've been looking at so far, and also what you used in last week's tutorial, is models where every neuron in a given layer is connected to every single neuron in the next layer. So every neuron in, say, layer L is connected to every neuron in L plus 1. So this is very general, that we would want to connect everything to everything. But let me tell you a potential issue with this structure. So a lot of data that we might be looking at is going to have properties such as translational invariance and locality. And these kinds of networks, because they're so general and every neuron is connected to everything else, they don't have those kind of properties inherently built in. So we can try to learn them, but that can take a lot of time to learn. So it can be a bit of a limitation that these fully connected networks don't exploit these properties. And these kinds of properties are often inherent to physical systems like an icing model that we might be studying, but also to images. So what this means, again, it doesn't have to be a problem. We can learn this kind of issue, but we then have to devote resources to learning this kind of information, which we might be reasonably able to assume. Okay, so to make it really clear what I mean, let's consider what we've been doing so far. If we had a 2D input, maybe an image or a spin configuration. So let's just consider a very simple 4x4 image. This could be like a picture of your dog, an icing spin configuration. And when we do this, we've seen in tutorials, we have to choose some kind of a labeling convention. So there's, of course, various ways you could do this labeling, but let's say that I choose something like this, where I start at the bottom and I go left to right and then I go up. Something like this. And then we've seen that when we take this as an input to a fully connected feed-forward neural network, we basically just flatten this image to be 1D. So then, what we're going to give as input to this network is something like this. Now, but if I look back at my image here, I can see these two pixels are close to each other spatially in the original image, where these two, 4 and 5, are actually quite far apart. But they're treated completely equally in a fully connected network. Maybe you can say on a 4x4 lattice, they're still like somewhat close, but of course you can imagine cases where those would be very far apart. So we see here this idea that locality is lost, like preserving the most local features is not maintained when we flatten like this. Does anyone have questions about just kind of the motivation so far of wanting to introduce a more sophisticated network structure than this? Like, does this motivation make sense? Yeah? Okay. Any questions? Okay. So a solution to this, it's the first point on the outline. It's these local receptive fields. So the idea is that rather than doing this flattening kind of operation, we're going to process our data in some patches that allow us to preserve the dimensional structure of our original data. So let me draw an example of what this might look like. If I take some input data that's 4x4, this is the input to my network. So if you remember, we often said the input was A0. We can still use that notation. That would be for this whole grid. Now what I'm going to do is look at my data in patches. So in this example, I would have like a square patch that has length 2. And one thing I might do is build connections with, again, some weights, just like we saw before, that are going to take me to some new points here. So I would process data in this patch here, in this local way, and use that to determine the value on the next layer here. And we would, of course, do this for various patches here. So what we apply here, we call these filters, but they're really just components of a weight matrix, which I'll write out explicitly for you in a minute. So, and then of course on the next layer, we would also have a 3x3, we would also have still a two-dimensional set of neurons. Okay, and of course, there's many ways that we can do this. So, of course, I just gave an example of these 2x2 patches, but you can imagine these patches can be many things. So it can be a bigger square, it can be a more general shape. This is just introduces a whole other set of hyperparameters for our training. Also, if you imagine, so we've often been considering data sets that have periodic boundary conditions, but of course you might be processing an image that's not periodic, and then you'll notice that in doing this, there might be some things might be changed at the edges. So things that are on the very boundaries will be processed less frequently than the neurons that are in the middle. So sometimes you might just pad zeros around the edge of your image just so that you introduce kind of a more of an equal footing for those ones that are on the boundary. So if I have some image X that has length L, I could pad it with zeros. You can see this would kind of increase the dimension of my image for processing. Again, another thing you could play around with is something called stride. And so maybe we look at this, and especially, you know, if our patch is big, we'll see that we're going to be processing some neurons within many patches. But maybe we want to try the case where we're still only processing everything once, or we're processing every neuron a little bit less, not with every possible patch. We can take steps rather than using every possible patch here. So I'll show you what that means. So let me redraw this same example above, but if in an example where I incorporate a stride, in that example I've drawn, I've assumed the stride is just one. So again, we start with something that's 4x4. If my stride is 2, it would mean that the patches I process would have a larger spacing between them. So I'm weighting a step size of 2 before I apply a new filter. So each of these patches is going to work all together to give me some neuron on the next layer. So now you can see I would have something smaller on the next layer, which could lead to more efficient training, of course. So, and of course, you can probably even imagine further ways to generalize this. So for example, you could in principle do a different stride in the x and y dimensions. Maybe your x and y dimensions of your input are different. They're not going to be treated equally. Then you could imagine having different parameters that you do in each direction as well. So there's lots of ways you can generalize this. So, but with these kind of generalizations that I've specified, let me just say that if your input layer has L times L neurons, then we can use these different parameters to calculate the number on the next layer. So then, again, we get here we're kind of assuming that we maintain something square. So if I assume square patches, then this is the number that I would have on my next layer. And let me note that a lot of the times in the models we've been studying in this course, we've been using periodic boundary conditions, as I said, rather than padding our image, or rather than having something special at the boundary. if we apply periodic boundary conditions instead of padding, then we get a simpler expression. We're just going to divide by this stride that we have. Does anyone have questions about that? Okay, so now I want to talk about the idea of channels, so the next point on this list. So actually, Cole drew this nice image from our model yesterday, which is going to be useful for motivating this. So far, everything I've drawn for you in these examples have just been really straightforward square two-dimensional grids. But if you remember for our gauge theory that we studied in tutorial, and we also talked about it in another lecture, the spins don't live just in a square lattice. They live on the bonds here, so it's slightly more complicated than just a square lattice, but it's still two-dimensional. So the idea of channels is going to be helpful for processing this kind of data. Okay, so instead of just thinking of two coordinates for our input, we can think of an additional channel index. So this would mean for our input, we could index by some spatial indices, which is just what I've been drawing so far. And we can have an optional channel index. Again, you might not always add this, depending on the type of data that you have, but you can add this third dimension. Okay, so let's stop thinking about Ising models and physical models that we've been studying, and let's just think of images for a minute. And maybe some of you have studied this already. Does anyone know what a channel might be useful for in images? Specifically, images with color. Okay, I thought maybe some of you had learned it, but I'll just tell you. So in colors, sometimes this is going to be like your RGB, different color indices. It's commonly used like that. So at every pixel, we might actually have, at every XY coordinate, we might actually have three coordinates corresponding to RGB. The way I can think of this, if I'm thinking of these spin configurations, is that it's labeling some sublattices, and I'll show you what I mean by that. That means that rather than every filter that I've been drawing, which I am going to write an actual equation for soon, rather than it just being L patch by L patch, we have a third dimension corresponding to the number of channels. So yeah, just as I said, we would then have these filters that we're going to process in these local ways are going to have dimension if they're square patches, L patch by L patch by NC, where I'm saying that's the number of channels that I have. So let me just remind you again of the lattice we used for this Z2 gauge theory yesterday. So, way I can think of this is I can build this from a square lattice. So, on my square lattice, I might think of, I'll draw them as circles. So these circles are maybe the sites of the lattice. Maybe this is kind of how I want to define my xy coordinates is from this lattice. And what I can do is I can think that every one of those sites has two sublattice points associated with it. So the first sublattice I'll draw as these triangles. And then my other sublattice would be the ones that are vertically above each site. So now I have a lattice I'm just denoting as two sublattices here. And let me kind of just like zoom in on one site to really show you what this means. So if I label my lattice sites as xy, it means for every lattice site, there's two sublattice points that we have to consider. So I can sort of think of my lattice in the way I've drawn it as being built up of these components. So there's a site, then I have a point on each sublattice. So I might think of my lattice site as having xy coordinates, then the two data points I need to consider associated with that site are x, y, and then channel 1. And then this one is going to maybe be x, y, channel 2. So I don't know, maybe it's still confusing, but I think yesterday in the tutorial, a lot of you were confused for the beginning about the labeling that was chosen for the site. So maybe now you see the inspiration that for every Lattice site, we are still for the sites going from left to right and then up and down, just like on that 16 site grid there. And then we're going over the sub-lattices for each point. So we're going here, here, and here, here. So we're kind of looping on this, and then for each one going to the right and then up for the two sub-lattices. Does the, again, once I've introduced all the terms here, I'm going to give you an actual expression for what we're doing in these networks. But does the idea of these channels make sense? Are there any questions about that? Okay. No, you can always interrupt with questions if you have them. Actually, while I have it here, can you just let me know where is the boundary of where I should stop writing? Is it like more over here?
For me, it's like there.
There's like a.
Like, a I guess it's probably not helpful. But it's like, I think it's like the lower half of that thing.
Can you see everything that's here now or is some blocked? Okay.
But, you know, I think you're good.
Okay.
There's like a pretty large margin too.
Okay, so you guys really have to tell me if I. I'm always scared of doing that, but I think I always like way overdo it. So. Let me know. Okay, so let's now talk about shared weights and biases, and then I'll finally be able to give you an equation. Okay, so the idea here is that rather than each patch that we process using different weights and biases, we can actually share weights and biases across our image. So the local receptive field can move across the data, but the weight and biases associated with the filters that we're using don't have to change. So each filter, as we'll write explicitly in a minute, has some weights and biases associated with it. These don't have to change as we move this filter along the image. Okay, so just hearing this description that we're going to take some patches, and then for every link here, we're going to apply, there's going to be some weights there. But maybe every time I apply that patch somewhere else, there's going to be the same weights rather than different. Does anyone have an intuition for why I might want to do this? What kind of physical property this might kind of correspond to? And if it's not clear, that's okay, but I just want
translational invariant?
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to impose that we shouldn't be treating any region differently from another one.
Is this mainly used in like many body physics or like in like other areas where CNNs are used, would they use this property?
You could use it elsewhere too. So for another way you could think of it, if you have an image, I'm trying to think of. So maybe in an image, you're trying to recognize how many cats are in a picture or something like that. Maybe you want to impose that like there's no like difference between a cat being here versus a cat being here.
Oh,
like so it still should be translationally invariant. What you're trying to recognize should not depend on the location that you're at in the image. So that's another way you could think of translational invariance in an image. Because again, it doesn't mean that the image itself is symmetric, right? It means that the theory that you expect to underlie that data has some translational invariance. Like the spin configurations we look at, they're not always symmetric, right? They can be different in the left corner versus the right corner, but we still have a reason to expect that the underlying theory is translationally invariant.
So this does translational invariance. Is there like something different you could do if you want like rotational invariance or?
Ah, that's a good question.
Invariance under reflection or something else.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I'm sure you could, yeah. Maybe I should make this an exercise at some point for you guys to design what you should do to impose that. But yeah, I'm sure this is possible too. Yeah. So yeah, in general, I guess what you want to be thinking in machine learning is, given whatever data set that you have, what are the physical properties that are reasonable to assume? But you don't want to assume too much because you don't want to impose constraints that might not really be there. So if you, for whatever reason, know for a fact that your data is rotationally invariant or something, then yeah, that's maybe something you want to impose in the structure of your network, which like, I'm sure is possible. I just don't know exactly how to write it down, but I'm sure it's possible. Yeah. So let me just write that conclusion. Okay, so again, what this means, a way to say this, is that the transformation applied by this convolutional layer, which is what we've been describing this whole time, is translationally invariant. So again, to just think back to an example we've seen many times in this class, in the Ising model, so we could compare this with the Ising model. Maybe we see kind of a parallel here, that here we're assuming our coupling is the same no matter where we are. So you know, we might be considering a case where we do or do not know the Hamiltonian describing our data. But in many cases, we have a reasonable expectation that our data should be translationally invariant. Okay. Now I need to write a big equation, so I'm going to go to a new board. So even though we're going to say that we have these shared weights and biases, it doesn't mean we're limited to only one filter that's moving around. We still might be looking for a lot of different attributes in our data. So we can still have lots of different filters. But all of them are going to move around our data with this translational invariance property. So imagine I'm at layer L. Then to get the output at the next layer, if this is a convolutional layer, I might apply NF different filters. Each of them will be of size L patch by L patch by LC. This will be applied to the output from the previous layer. And what this gives means that at layer L, what I'm going to get here, I'll still have some activation function. Now I just have a more complicated expression because I've introduced these different directions. So I have to sum over the weights in one direction of my patch, in the other direction of my patch, and also over channels. And I'm going to shift this all around the image. But if I'm looking at what I want to get at point X, Y, then I need to look at everything that's within the patch of X in the previous layer. So like this, there's going to be some weights here. And I'm still going to have a bias. OK, so let me just label the points of this and kind of break it down a bit. So just like before, have an activation function. And then this here is called a convolution. And this is the bias. And in here, I've taken the stride to be 1. So you could modify this expression if the stride is not 1. OK. And let me just break down this weight matrix to be clear what the indices are. Okay. So we have one index that slides along X, one for Y, C is for my channels or sublattices that I need to sum over, and K is indexing the number of filters that I have. So number of filters you have would be a hyperparameter, and then K is going to go between 1 and the number of filters. Okay, so let me just mention that in addition to kind of exploiting this property of translational invariance from the design of this layer, you can also see that because of these shared weights and biases, this convolutional layer will have a lot fewer free parameters than you would have if you weren't assuming this sharing. So again, this statement is assuming that your number of filters is not huge, but in many cases, CNNs will have a lot fewer parameters that they need to learn during training because we impose this shared weights, these shared weights and biases. And this means it's often possible to push the limits of CNNs to larger sizes of data, input data, than you could with fully connected networks. So we, in many cases, are going to be able to use CNNs for larger input data sizes and impose deeper layers compared to fully connected networks. Of course, this is only going to work well if your actual data has the properties that we're imposing. So if the data set that you're looking at really is translationally invariant and local. Okay, so now let's just talk about the last point that was on my outline that I've now erased, which is pooling. So pooling is, there's various ways in these networks that we can do a type of coarse graining. So we're going to perform some kind of a coarse graining operation. It's sometimes called downsampling after this convolutional layer. And we also still want to do it in a way that preserves the structure of the data. So in doing this, we're going to be losing information. But it can be useful if you have data that has really high correlations or has redundant information in it. Then you can imagine that your training could become faster if you do some kind of operation like this. Okay, so let me draw again an example for you. So maybe after I've applied sorry, it's a bit confusing because you can see the previous thing that I had underneath, which was very similar. Let me try to erase that. Okay, so if imagine this is the output that I have after a convolutional layer. Then I might again apply some patches, but this time I'm going to do some kind of a pooling operation to them. So, of course, there's many ways to do this, but in this example, I'm showing you, I'm going to label four sites for each patch that I've drawn. Each one is 2x2 here, and pooling here will take me, each of these patches might take me to just one input, and this operation, oh sorry, let me redraw this, sorry. I'm going to draw these actually as squares, I forgot. So I'm going to say that each of these four initial neurons is going to give me one new neuron. I'm just labeling it as a square. And I can have lots of different choices for what this square can be. It might be the maximum of everything that I had before. It might be the average. Or if you have discrete data, you might choose it to be the majority. Okay, so just a couple more notes about this. So again, information is lost when you do this coarse grading, but you can speed up your training. And let me also note that if you have different channels to your data, you typically wouldn't do pooling across channels. You would only do it spatially. Because we expect this coarse graining to be more of a spatial notion, not across channels. Okay, any questions about any of these pieces that we've talked about, of these CNNs? Okay, so the last thing I want to say is just how do we combine all of this to build a full network that takes input and goes all the way to output? So what I've been telling you about for the majority of the class is how to build a convolutional layer. But as we've seen, we can have many layers in a network. So the convolutional layer would be one. This pooling layer would be another layer. And so there's lots of choices for how you can build up an entire network. So I won't say too much about this because the way you build it is just kind of another hyperparameter. But let me just say that what's a common thing to do is to start by implementing some convolutional layers. And after a convolutional layer, you might choose to add this pooling layer. And after you've done that, it is typical then to use some fully connected layers after you've done this. So in this afternoon's tutorial, what we're going to do is we're going to examine code that implements a convolutional neural network with some of these different layers that I'm describing here. And we're going to apply it to study spin configurations from this Z2 gauge theory that we were looking at yesterday and see if we can recognize order in that model. We haven't done it explicitly, but so in the homework, you're using a fully connected network to study an icing model, and you'll see that you'll be successful there. It turns out that those fully connected networks are not successful at classifying the topological order in the Z2 gauge theory. But we're going to see that the convolutional neural network is able to do that in this tutorial today. So, and I had a few animations and pictures I wanted to show that are nice because convolutional neural networks are a little hard to draw. So I wanted to show you some pictures, but I think because we're already a few minutes past 10, I'll show those in the tutorial this afternoon at the beginning because we're working with the same kind of network in the tutorial. So I'll bring down the screen during tutorial and show those. And they're also linked in the portal and in the lecture notes if you want to look at those. So any questions about CNNs or anything else? Okay, so see you in tutorial. We don't have any more lectures this week because I'll be out of town. At the end of this week, I'll still be able to answer emails if you have questions about the homework. But our next lecture will be next week, but we still have a tutorial this afternoon.